This is Bill Teeple. I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. So Alan is the president of the Icon Sound Institute, because his field of expression is ranges all over the place, but particularly the area of sound and acoustics. So he's found a new book that he says is great, and he's going to tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I ran across this a little while ago. It's a book by William Sathares. I have no idea if that's the correct pronunciation. Called Tuning Timbre Spectrum Scale. And it's published by Springer. You can find it on springeronline.com. And it's a very interesting little book. He's a professor at Wisconsin, and he's been exploring the relationship between timbre and tuning. And just to refresh everyone's memory, timbre is what we often refer to as the color or texture of a sound. When a flute plays middle C and a trumpet plays middle C, the difference between those two, even though they're playing supposedly the same note, is the color of the sound. You know it's a flute because it sounds like a flute, not because it's playing middle C. So the different colors of sounds are tremendously varied, and we're accustomed not to thinking about timbre very much outside of orchestration. If you listen to an orchestra and you're familiar with orchestral music, you can hear the oboes and separate them in your mind from the flutes and the other woodwinds and the violins and the other brasses and things. And that's all on the basis of timbre. And the study of harmony goes into, you know, why we like particular kinds of chords and why particular intervals or the spaces between two notes are more pleasing or less pleasing. And harmony as a study pretty much comes down to the notion of consonance or the dual notion of the opposites, consonance and dissonance. When I say consonance, there's no T in that. It's not like the letter L is a consonant. It means consonance. It sounds together. Sounds which sound together are consonant. And sounds which fight one another are dissonant. And the conventional knowledge is that the most perfect consonance is an octave. If you play middle C and the note of an octave above middle C, which is another C, the two of them are similar in so many respects that they sound almost like one note playing at the same time, almost like one note. And if you look at the frequency spectrum of these two notes, you find that there's something very special about the octave. It's exactly double the frequency. So if you double the frequency again, you get the octave, you get the second octave above middle C. And if you double that frequency, you get the third octave above middle C. And it works very consistently. And that principle of perfect consonance at the octave is really the essence of what harmony is all about. The next best interval is the fifth, from C to G on a piano, and if you play those two notes, it sounds very open and maybe a little bit hollow, but it sounds very stable and settled, and it's easy to relate to. If you change the interval to something a little bit odd, for example, C and C sharp, which are very close to each other, they don't go together very well at all, and you get this funny sort of jangly, jarry mixture of sound that really sounds like a mixture. It doesn't sound like two notes working together. And so you have the maximum harmony or maximum consonance, I should say, at the octave, and the second best is the fifth, and the third best is the fourth, and the major third, and so on. And these happen to also be the resonances of strings and air columns. When you play a trumpet, you very quickly learn that the open tones that don't involve using any of the valves are a fifth, and then a fourth, and then a third, and then a minor third or a second, and so on. And for those who play trumpets, I probably screwed that up a little bit, but I was close. It's been a long time since I played the trumpet.
And those are based on whole number relationships.
So that's
two
right.
To three and three to four and
exactly.
Four to five and like that. Right?
Exactly. The relationship of the frequency of the fifth to the tonic is...
two to three.
It's I forget now. I should probably be looking it up in this book, which I'm holding in my hand while we're talking about it. In fact... the octave is 1 to 2, the fifth is 2 to 3, the fourth is 3 to 4, the major third is 4 to 5, and so on. These are just totally understood, and the mathematical neatness of it is very appealing to people, especially in the West. And it turns out that maximum consonance isn't always the octave. And this is what William Seferi's is bringing out in this book, Tuning Timbre, Spectrum, and Scale. And he noticed this rather strange phenomenon that at first glance seems to really turn the whole world of harmony analysis and the mathematics of it upside down. Because if you ask anyone who's studied harmony what happens when you double the frequency, they'll tell you you get an octave and you get perfect consonants. Well, you do get an octave, but you don't necessarily get perfect consonants. You may get horrendous dissonance, and you may get perfect or best consonants at some completely unrelated interval with no clean mathematical relationship to the original note. And I've mentioned this to a few musician friends of mine, and they've all said, no, that you've got to be mistaken. It can't be like that. That's not the way it works. And it's so obvious why it works the way it works that it's hard to even believe that there's anything wrong.
Are you saying that experience of it, of them fitting together,
yes,
happens even though there's no mathematical correspondence?
Yes. Yes, it turns
that's
out.
That's hard for me to get my wrap my brain around.
Well, in what context are we talking about?
Well, imagine a musical instrument playing a note, mm-hmm. and you have that instrument play a note that's exactly one octave higher, mm-hmm. Or have two of these instruments, and the second one plays it an octave higher, mm-hmm. and the two together just sound awful. Mm-hmm. But if the second instrument plays it an octave and two semitones higher, then it sounds like an octave. It sounds perfect. But it's not double the frequency anymore. It's a little more than double the frequency, some weird relationship that isn't, you know, it's almost not worth mentioning. And similarly, you could arrange an instrument whose tone produces maximum consonants at 9.5 semitones instead of 12. And at 12, it would sound horrible. And in fact, you can arrange the timbre of a sound in such a way that you can have it have maximum consonance at whatever frequency,
so
whatever interval you like.
What we're getting to here is that timbre has a lot more to do this than
exactly.
we ever. It's all usually left out of the equation.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's what's so wonderful to me you know, I call my albums Timbre, and my website is Timbre Productions, and timbre is what I've been studying for the last 10 years, and here I finally stumbled on something that says that timbre is a critical component in harmony. Now, it should be, but we just haven't been considering it.
It's very interesting. It shows bias.
Yes.
And I'll just make a quick analogy with art. When you teach art, you teach hue, value, and intensity, the color mm-hmm. issues. Hue meaning the colors. So the color harmony is always an important compositional element. And value is dark and light. So dark and light is obviously one of the main structural elements that you hang your composition on. But what people don't notice when they're amateurs and they're beginning to paint is that whether the colors are dull or fully saturated, which you call intensity or chroma, is as significant to the equally as important as the colors you choose, the dark and light, and yet nobody does it when they learn because they've got a bias for dark and light and color and not for intensity.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, but the adjacent colors, you know, of course, affect how we perceive color.
Well, now we're getting into another area. Why don't you finish your line of thought, because we could go, I was just talking about bias as opposed to the color wheel
This is a bias too. I mean, I'm not talking about the way that a color interacts by proximity. I'm talking about the way that the content of the picture changes the way you perceive the colors in the picture. If you know that the picture is of something that you know about, then you will change in your mind the lighting on the scene so that the colors that you're seeing come out the way they're supposed to, as if they were lit that way, even though those spectral components may not be in the painting at all.
Which is why when you look closely, if you're in a museum or something and you look closely at a painting and spend some time with it, you will be astonished to see that, oh my goodness, this is purple.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my goodness, you know, this is the oddest green I've ever seen, you know, and you see how brilliant painters actually are, that they knew to use those colors.
In a sense, being able to see color for what it is rather than for what it means. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so anyway, Bill hit the nail on the head. The essence of Seathary's discovery or observation is that timbre has everything to do with tuning and harmony and consonance and dissonance. And if you look at what timbre means, I mean, timbre is a very rich thing. You could define timbre in a kind of technical way as the history of the partials of a tone as they change over time. Now, the partials are the resonant frequencies, the overtones and undertones.
Can you define it, though? I mean, you defined it before as like the color.
The color or the texture.
Is there some definition that's a little less general than saying the color or the texture, but a little less technical and specific than that other definition?
Well, yeah. I mean, ultimately, timbre is a very, very complex notion. Because it involves the way we actually respond to a sound. And so it's possible for timbre to be so complicated based on the way that we're interpreting something that we're hearing that there's no way to define the timbre of that in any kind of sensible or systematic way. In the case of musical instruments, timbre is... at its simplistic level, it's the set of overtones and undertones for a particular, overtones
of
for
a violin.
Yeah,
but it's all about the partials, right?
Yeah, so it's all about the partials, which is just a fancy word for overtones.
Overtones and, is clearer to me than partials.
Partials is a technical word for it. And the idea is that, and it goes to this, you may have heard of Fourier analysis if you've read, you know, EEG charts and things from the research on TM. Basically, Fourier analysis is a mathematical way of looking at the timbre of a sound, looking at a sound, and breaking it down into a combination of sine waves at different frequencies. And sine wave is the simplest possible waveform that has a repeating structure. Of course, just a spike is even simpler than that. But that doesn't quite have any tendency to repeat. But a sine wave is a pure tone. It's like a laser beam. It's a single frequency with no overtones and no undertones, no partials at all. And so, if you had 100 sine wave generators, all just tiny different distances apart in frequency, each one a slightly higher pitch than the next, you could take any particular sound and break it down into a list of which of those sine wave generators should be involved and how loud they should be set. So if you had a little volume control on each one of these 500 sine wave generators, you'd be able to exactly match any particular sound.
With all its overtones and
all of its overtones
and everything.
Yeah, because all its overtones would fit into one of those, would land on one of those sine wave generators. Now, that's, it turns out to be a very idealistic approach to it. When the Hammond organ was designed, that's what they were trying to do.
Oh, so that's why Hammond organ sounds so cool.
They do have a very interesting sound because the sound is generated electromechanically instead of with electronics. The main electronics is they're spinning a wheel, disc, and it's a disc made out of ferrous metal, mm-hmm. or you know iron-based metal, and it's got a scalloped edge, mm-hmm. and it's spinning right next to a coil of wire, and as that scalloped edge goes by, it moves closer and farther and closer and farther away from the coil, and induces a little current in the coil, which we hear as an audio signal when you amplify it. And the idea was that if you had maybe 8 or 9 of these scalloped wheels that set with more scallops, so each wheel is a higher pitch, that by mixing those, you'd be simulating a pipe organ in a sense, but you'd be simulating it with these more perfect mm-hmm. sine waves. Then you could mix up practically any sound. Well, of course, 9 isn't enough. You need at least 100, maybe 200 or 300 to do a fairly decent job of simulating any particular sound. But it's much worse than that because when you create that particular set of loudnesses, the settings for those sine wave generators, that may describe the way the sound sounds in the first thousandth of a second that you hear it. But a couple of thousandths of a second later, you may have to readjust all those little volume controls. Yeah. And another few thousandths of a second later, they need to be changed again because the ratio of the partials mm. is changing dynamically over time.
In any particular musical instrument.
Yeah, pretty much any instrument except mm-hmm. maybe a penny whistle. Mm-hmm. And so that richness of tone is partially coming from the fact that those partials are constantly changing.
Wow.
And so to simulate an instrument using reverse Fourier analysis like this by additive synthesis of many, many sine waves is extremely difficult. It requires 21st century computers to do it. Mm-hmm. We can do it now, and we do it. You can buy a synthesizer online for $100 that'll do it. Mm-hmm. But it's tricky to compose a sound that way because we have no intuitive sense of what those partials do to the sound.
Well, and they never do. Like any of the best synthesizer, it doesn't really sound like a trumpet or by, you know,
oh,
when you
well, yeah.
set it to the settings of different
faking an instrument. I mean, even when you use a waveform that's an actual recording of a trumpet mm-hmm. so that it really is a trumpet, mm-hmm. It's only a trumpet at that particular loudness, with that particular intonation and that particular attack and played in that particular style, mm-hmm. when you add all the other human elements to it, making it play like a trumpet is a whole different
right.
thing from making one note sound like a trumpet.
Yeah.
I mean, you could obviously record a trumpet and that one note will sound like a trumpet and it'll fool everyone. But to make it sound like a trumpet player playing a trumpet is a whole different ballgame. So the Fourier approach, this partials approach, leads us to why timbre and tuning work the way they do. All the instruments in the Western world have been designed to work nicely with our scale. And our scale is designed to work nicely with these clean mathematical relationships. We like the consonants of the octave and the fifth and the fourth and the third. Mm-hmm. And we like the dissonance of a minor triad, and we like the way the relative minor kind of resolves into the tonic and things like that. There are certain combinations of notes and combinations of chords or sequences of chords that we like. They make us feel good. And that's very cultural. But it has resulted in instruments that do obey all of the mathematical suppositions we made about an octave sounding perfect and a fifth sounding almost perfect. And it turns out that if you change the partials, if you move those overtones around a little bit and make them a little bit higher and lower and stuff, so that they're not nice, neat harmonic partials that also fit the same mathematics, then when you double the frequency, you may be causing the third main partial and the seventh major partial to overlap and add up and create a much stronger partial in that position and result in a sound that doesn't fit well with the octave at all. So there are various types of sounds that when you double the frequency, they don't sound great at all. Well, it turns out all you have to do is look to percussion instruments, especially surface-based percussion instruments as opposed to string-based or tine-based percussion instruments. I mean, technically the piano is a percussion instrument, but you're whacking a string, which is a two-dimensional thing. Instruments that have three-dimensional resonating surfaces, like drums or metallophones, like a gamelan instrument or a steel drum from the Caribbean. Those things, they resonate according to multiples of the square root of 2. The math that describes what's happening in the resonances of surfaces is much more complicated than the resonance of strings or air columns in a flute. And if you take the sound of a metallophone and double the frequency, it doesn't sound that great. If you listen to melodic bells, recordings of carillons, I'm thinking of Spanish. If you listen to recordings of carillons, you always notice that, you know, when they sort of finish up and you hear the root of the scale that they are playing in, it always sounds just a little bit off. And it's not because the bells are not properly tuned, usually. It's because bells are surface areas. They're metallophones, and they're big two-dimensional surfaces resonating according to more complicated math that doesn't fit the simple octave notion that we have with linear kinds of instruments. So we've been dealing with timbre affecting harmony all along. We just never really thought about it separately. And what's interesting is that now with the software that we have for synthesizing waveforms, it's very easy, and Mr. Sathari's in this book, there's a CD that you can download from Springer that generates tones which will be sounding consonant at whatever interval you like. So you can say, I want it to sound great at, 13 semitones. And then so it'll give you a waveform that'll sound great at 13 and it'll sound terrible at 12. But if you're writing music for a 13-tone scale, then it's kind of nice. So it opens up the possibility of composing whole new kinds of music and whole new scales with instruments that are actually compatible with those scales, instead of trying to shoehorn Western instruments into scales that may not be compatible with their particular partials.
This is very cool, in the idea of inventing completely new instruments.
Yeah, I mean, new instruments and new tunings have been around for a long time, and some people have done wonderful things. Parch, obviously, is well known, and Wendy Carlos has created some really beautiful alternate tunings that produce chords that you've never heard before, and they're wonderful. They have colors and inner movement in them and stuff that's heartbreaking or fascinating in various ways. And this just sort of gives us some additional control over designing sounds which can then be used melodically in scales that we've never attempted before. Makes it all really kind of convenient.
But have other cultures attempted these scales? Is this something completely brand new worldwide, or are there other cultures who have used these?
Well, the other the tunings that emerge in a culture are going to be determined more or less by what they like about the timbre of the instruments right. that they use.
So I think of the West, really, and I think mm-hmm. of everything else. And I think everybody else is playing around with this stuff in various degrees, aren't they? With their tunings, because the harmonics of Chinese music and different...
Oh, yeah. I mean, tunings
seems a whole other ballgame from the West.
Right. And even in the West, you know, with the sort of even-tempered scale tuning that we use right now, because the math doesn't really work all the way. You can't get a 12-tone scale and have a perfect fifth and a perfect fourth and play in all keys and have a perfect fifth and fourth in all the different keys, because it just doesn't distribute all the way through. But cultures that have been, like in gamelan music, where all the instruments are percussion instruments, they're metallophones of various kinds, they use very different tunings. They have specific octaves. Five and seven note octaves that they use primarily in Java gamelan and Balinese gamelan, and those are kind of overlapping. They don't use the same notes, so you can switch from one of those scales to the other, and have both scales working in the same composition. And they're based on the relationships of the way that these metal things, these gongs, sound when you make them bigger and smaller. So there's a cultural side to it, and then it's just that in the modern Western world, we have the opportunity to synthesize waveforms with whatever timbral properties we want. So we can tweak it to make it work in a particular scale. And there are, even in the West, I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of scales. Some of them are really quite interesting. And even in 12 tones, there are probably hundreds of 12-tone tunings. Yeah. So it's a great book. I recommend it to anyone who's interested in what we've just been talking about.
Say the name of the book again.
Yeah, it's called Tuning, Timbre, Spectrum, Scale. And it's published by Springer. And you can find it on Amazon, or you can get it from springeronline.com. The author is William Sethares, Sethares.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.